Well, good afternoon. My name's Don C. I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Don.
Hi, everybody. And also a member of Al-Anon. I found that certain periods of my recovery, I could not get what I needed to get just from AA. I have 9 children altogether, and out of that 9 children, we have a 20 and a half grandbabies. There's one due in October, and my children are not.
I'm gonna go play.
Okay. Okay.
Let's go, Alatees. Let's go play. <Hello?
laughs> Can you believe those Alatees can get up here and just? Wow, they just say it. That's so awesome. My 2 oldest sons, one's 50 and one's mid-40s, and to this day they talk about their days in Alateen. Because in those days, Alateen, they had a very good Al-Anon was running Alateen in Colorado Springs where we lived, and they still talk about it today. Things like "it saved my life," or they talked about they had no one to talk to and they didn't know how to. And fortunately, they got there, and it was a life-changing thing, you know, for them. So, I'm from the Mohican Nation. Our nation is a clan system, so I was born for the Turtle Clan. On my mother's side, we're a matriarchal community. My Indian name is Tontanka Wambli. That name was given to me by the elders when I was given the responsibility to be the keeper of this hoop of 100 eagle feathers. That was given to me as a responsibility when I was just about 4 years sober. I didn't want it, but elders have a way of convincing you that that's what you need to do. And so this staff here is it's called, every staff when it's made, it is for a purpose. This one is called a forgiveness staff, because elders, when we made a journey across the United States to the boarding schools, one of the things they told us is we had to tell the people that what happened between the United States government and our tribes, they said one of the things we would need to now consider to be free would be forgiveness. And the ones that made the staff, they put on this staff 36 eagle feathers. That was the forgiveness staff. And sometime later, that was such an odd number, I said, why 36 feathers? And they said, that's the program that's going to help us to recover. 12 steps, 12 traditions, and 12 concepts. And that's why it has 36 feathers on it. And I thought, well, that's very insightful to have Native elders look at what's going on, you know, in that way. And so this gathering has been very, very moving. I don't know, as I said, in this energy of that much honesty and people just saying it, just putting it out there. And I keep thinking, you know, in our beliefs, all those feelings and all those thoughts, they go in that hoop. That hoop has like a memory. And I think to have it sitting here in the sacredness of the Al-Anons, it's going to change when we take it out to the communities. You know, it's not going to be who it was before. It's going to be different. So I was told when I come in here that all I was to do is to tell you my story, the story of what it was, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so I will do that. And they also, in our culture, they always say that when you are in the presence of an eagle feather, just one eagle feather, you're supposed to always tell the truth. And I'm going, God, I'm standing here with 138 eagle feathers, you know. What'll happen if I slip and say something that's not right, you know? this is not good. I never stood in front of this much power before. So I'll tell you what happened, and I think the best way I can tell that is to tell a story. This story was given to me very, very early in my sobriety. And in our culture, what you're supposed to do, as I understand it, is if somebody gives you their song, then you don't go and make believe that song is yours. Before you sing it, you have to say, this song was given to me by, so they know where it came from. And so that's the same way here. This isn't my story I'm going to tell you. This story is given to me by a man named Don P., very, very early in my sobriety. I've had three influential men in my recovery. One was Frank McKibben. One is Don P., Don Pritz. And the other was a man named Johnny Looking Cloud. Johnny Looking Cloud is the one that helped me to see that this wasn't a white man's program. But he had been in this program for 40-some years when he took me under his wing. And so I remember I would come to this program and I couldn't get it. I would slip, and for no reason at all. And my family was, the whole thing was very, very shaky. And when I went out and slipped that last couple of times, that was it. I ended up getting kicked out of there, and should have been. But I couldn't get it. I couldn't get what was going on here. And so I had this friend of mine. He said, let's go up to Estes Park. He said, there's this Indian guy talking up there. Estes Park is a little community outside of Denver. And so I thought, okay, we'll go up there. It's a place called Harmony House. And so we went up there, and I walked in that room, and here this man sat at the table, and he had this big book in front of him. And that book was so used. It was dirty, coffee-stained, rubber-banded, falling apart, things written crossed in it, you know. And, you know, my book, my big book, it was like new even after I'd read it. There was nothing, you know, there's a big difference on who was getting this program and, you know, and who wasn't. And so I looked at this man, and he had the bluest eyes. He had blue eyes on him. In our culture, we have we talk sometimes about connectedness and what that means. It's easier to talk about this explanation than when it's in our language. English is sometimes different to understand something. And in our culture, when you get into the spirituality talk, there's seven levels of connectedness. Eight altogether, but seven. And the first one is always done with one of your five physical senses. So your eye will connect to another eye, or your hand connects, your body connects. Good job. It connects to a person. Your ear, you can connect all those senses. And when you look at somebody, if you ever notice this, you will look at someone, then there's a second later, there's a feeling goes across. Then when that happens, you nod, or you smile. So that feeling is called netashnya. And it, the kind of the English translation for that is a touch of love. That when you look at it happens. And sometimes you don't want to have that connectedness, especially you go like a country western bar right after last call, and they're trying to find that eye contact, you know, trying to hook up like this, and this is not good. You're always looking at me, and you looking the other way and stuff. And then, that's not what I'm talking about, actually. Sorry. I was just kidding you. Better be careful. But anyway, I looked at that man, and he looked at me with those blue eyes and went, pshew. And it was a lifetime. It was forever. It never went away. And so he told a story that night that somehow went into my innermost being, that I was able to somewhat connect onto what I was to look at next. And he told this story, and it was a story about a boxing match. And in one corner, in the white trunks, there was alcohol. In the opposite corner, in the black trunks, that was me. I was sitting in there. And people were coming in and sitting in their seats and selling popcorn and all that stuff. They come in to watch what was going to go on here. And, of course, the very front row, when they have these events, they reserve that row. And that is reserved for your family. So they want that family to have the view, the best view of what's going to happen there. And so my family came in, they removed the ribbon, they all went and they sit down right in front of that row. And so me and alcohol, we started to kind of eye one another up. And it seemed like I looked at him in the eye and he went, chook, it connected. There was a connectedness happened between me, and that alcohol. And he'd have this smile on his face, is very appealing to me, like a good friend or something. So anyway, the referee brought us out, and he said, there's some rules. Now I'm going to explain these rules, and when I say break, hit and blow the belt, and he was going on, and we just were watching one another's eyes, and we both agreed to the rules of the fight. And so we went, and we sit down, and it came time, the bell rung, we got out there, started boxing around. In the first couple of rounds, it wasn't too bad, just bouncing around and ducking and swinging at one another, not a big deal. But somewhere when he got out there, but that third round, I must have zigzagged the wrong way or something, and the alcohol really stung me a good one in my face, and it stunned me that it would hurt like that. And I looked at it, and his lips, he says, "You can beat me." He said, that was just a lucky punch, and it restored my confidence in myself, because I knew that alcohol was telling me the truth. And so as the rounds continued, got to four or five, alcohol was stinging me more often now. It was even hitting below the belt, and I look at the referee, and he didn't say nothing to the alcohol. It was illegally what he was trying to do. So I sat there, and every time there was that break, I'd be looking at the alcohol, and he'd look back, and his lips were going like, "You can whip me." That was a lucky punch. And I would still believe that the alcohol was telling me. Then I kind of caught out the corner of my eye. There was people, they started leaving. Because they, I guess, anticipated how that fight was going to come out. And so some more rounds went on. And I was getting pretty bloodied up. And I couldn't see very well. And I realized I had to get a strategy. I had to not just go out there and fight. I had to have some kind of a little plan. And so I put my plan together. And I got out there, and alcohol just stomped the hell out of me, once more. So I come back, and I sit down, and my eyes bloodied, all shut. And as I sit there, I felt this tug on my arm. And I looked down there, and this was my son. And I looked at him, and I says, "What?" And he said, "Dad," he says, "Mom says to tell you, climb down, and let's just all go home." He said, "Just come on, Dad." He said, "Just come down with us. We'll all go home and heal up from this." And I looked at him and I said, "Son," I said, "I want you to go back and sit down. I want you to watch what's going to happen next." I said, "I got some Indian moves that alcohol don't know about. I'm going to whop his ass." He said, "You just sit down there and you tell your brothers and sisters to watch." So bell rung, I went back out there, and alcohol just put me right to my knees. I was on my hands and knees and swinging at him and screaming, "You can whip me." That was a lucky punch, and I still believe in him. I still believe that I would be able to connect. And so gratefully that bell rung, and I was on my hands and knees back to the corner, sat down on my stool, and I was really trying to get a plan together. Now I knew this was I had to really focus, on what was going on here. And as I'm sitting there, I felt this tug on my arm again. And this time it was one of my little daughters. And she said, "Dad," she said, "Mom says to tell you, we're going to go. We're not going to watch this anymore. She said to tell you to come on down and let's all go home. We'll talk this over and figure it out." She said, and, she looked at me with his little beautiful Indian eyes, and, "Please, Dad, please, let's do it." And I looked at her, and I looked at alcohol, and I looked back at her, and I said, "I got one more move nobody's ever seen made in public." I said, "You go back there, you sit down, you tell your brothers and sisters to watch what your daddy's going to do." So we got out there, and this time alcohol put me in my stomach. I couldn't even stand. And I wasn't watching that family no more. They left. I don't remember exactly seeing them walk out. I don't remember, seeing that. And so they left, and I was laying out there, and the alcohol is now stomping on my head, and I could just see its tennis shoes. And I had this moment of clarity. I said, "I think this alcohol is lying." I said, I don't think I'm going to do it. So I crawled out of the arena, and the next morning I started thinking, and I said, I was out of shape. I said, "There's something I have to do." I said, "I think I'll go down to Barnes & Noble's. I'm going to get me some self-help books to kind of analyze what went on here. I'll get me some Dakai flute music and some candles, and I'm going to get some spinach and kale and make me a salad and get healthy." So I spent a month, and I was doing all those things, meditate and read and all this stuff. And then I got thinking. I said, I think I'm in shape now. I think I could go back there and whoop his ass if I really put my mind to it. So I said, "I'm going to go by there and just see." So I walked by there, opened up the door, and I looked in there, and there the alcohol is standing in that arena, his hands on the ropes. And I said, "Alcohol, I am back." And he said, "I knew you would be." And I said, "Okay, then we know what's going on here." So I walked up to that arena, and as I'm climbing through the ropes, he didn't even let me get in there and get my gloves on. He just knocked the crap out of me right there. And I fell back down on the floor. And I crawled out of that arena again. And next morning I woke up and I got thinking. And I said, "I think I went to the wrong bookstore. I'm gonna go to a different bookstore." There I go to another dang bookstore, and get some rope, some books, and new flute music and candles, and come back there. And this time I opened up the door to see if alcohol was still there, and he just dropped me in my tracks. Didn't even let me get to the darn arena. I just fell right on the floor, and it was stomping and kicking. And I had a moment of clarity that I understood what the book says, is that we first must concede to our innermost selves that we have this disease of alcoholism. I wasn't able to do that fully. If I was hungover, it'd be 80%, and then I feel good, it'd be 50%, never was sure. So that was on August 10th, 1978. And I left that arena, and I ain't been back there since, because I know that alcohol is in there, that little line, some bitch is still going to tell me he can whoop me, So anyway, all I knew, I didn't know where to go, but I knew I heard the AA. And so I said, "I'm going to go and see what this is about, this AA. I was living in Colorado Springs then, And there was a street there where the main meeting was. Tejon Street is called. And on that street, the cars parked like at a diagonal. It was sort of like one of those, I guess, the horse and buggy days streets or whatever. So I went down in the afternoon and I scoped it all out, where that meeting was, where the door was and everything. I didn't tell nobody I was going to go to there. So that come time for the meeting, I went down there and there was cars being parked, you know, as they come into the meeting. And right in front of that door, there was one slot that was empty. There was no car. It seemed they were parking on the other side for some reason. So I said to myself, I said, I'm gonna go around this block one time. If I go around this block and that slot is still there, then it's a sign from God I'm supposed to go on in. So I drove around that block and I come back there and the slot's empty. And I stopped there and I looked at that door and I looked at that slot and I said, okay, just to be sure, I'm going to go around that block just one more time. If that slot's there, then I'm going to go in. And so I drove as slow as that damn res car would go. I just keep my foot on the brake and everything else going around it. And sure enough, that slot was empty and I come around. So I drove in there. So I went up the steps where the meeting was and I peeked in the door to see, you know, what was going on in there. And my first thought that I can remember that I said when I looked in there, I says, oh my God, is this all white people in here? That's all there was just, you know, white guys. And so I said, I ain't going to get nothing, you know, from here. And as I turned around, that particular meeting had something they call a greeter. And he is a big old white guy. And before I knew it, I had a cup of coffee in my hand, and I was sitting down in that chair, and you know, in that circle, and I was kind of embarrassed, you know. So my strategy changed. I said, "Okay, I'll sit here and but I'm going to say nothing. I'm not going to tell this white people anything." So the meeting started. He went around. My name, so and so, went all the way. Come to me. I said, "I ain't telling them nothing." And so they kind of just picked up on it, and they finished the circle. And then the meeting started. And I don't remember a lot of content about that meeting. The couple of things I remember was they was telling on themselves. I couldn't believe these guys are sitting in there and talking about how they're selfish and how they're self-centered and, you know, where I come from, you didn't ever tell nobody no shit like that. This was not good, you know. But they were, and then the other thing drove me crazy was the laughter. They just laughed, belly laughing, not like hee, hee, hee. They got it on, you know, just belly laughing about what was going on. And I didn't see nothing funny about life or anything else. I didn't see why they was laughing so much. But the other thing that I remember when I was sitting there, is there was a feeling. There was just some kind of a crazy feeling was in there that I never, ever remember feeling before. And it was something about it was strong enough that when I went back, the second time I went back because I wanted to feel that feeling again. And so, but I wasn't sure what that, you know, what that was. Later on, I found out that's that feeling you get when you come home. When you've been away and you come back to family that you didn't know you had brothers and sisters and people who cared and loved. I didn't know what that was, but I found that in, you know, in the program. So as I sat there long enough listening, then I found out there were some things I needed to do. One of those things I needed to do was to have a sponsor. And so I listened to how you told me about selecting a sponsor, and so I watched, because you'd hear them say, well, if you want what we have, I said, I don't want what you have. I didn't see that wasn't a calling card to me, you know, you know, not at first, and because I didn't know what they were talking about. as I watch this, saw one man, and in some ways he was like an elder. That's how I felt. I listened to him, and he was pretty truthful and kind of a rough-talking guy, but I was kind of attracted to him. And so I asked him if he would be my sponsor. He said, "We'll talk about it." So after the meeting, we sit down, and he was about 6'6". He was a great big guy, white hair. He was an attorney, actually. And he's scarred up pretty good. He was used to fight a lot, I think, when he was drinking. And either that or he was hit with the ugly stick when he was a baby. That man was not pretty at all, you know. And he had this look on his face like he would, you know, he like sized me up. He would like look down my body and like look back up, and you could tell it was like disgust. That's how I interpreted how he was looking at me. And he said, "You know," he said, "I watch you Indians come into AA for 15 years. He said, "Y'all sit in the back row. No, that's where you guys always sit. And when it comes your turn," he says, "it's like a row. I pass, I pass, I pass, I pass, and then it comes back to us." And he said, "I don't think you guys catch on at all what's going on here." He said, "I saw one of you guys stay 6 months one time. Sat back there for 6 months every day." And he said, "There he was." And he said, you guys just don't seem to get it." And I don't know if you've ever been a kid and your dad bought you a little puppy dog or whatever, and when you're playing with that dog, you like tease it. You know how you like rub its face, trying to get it to growl and rough it up. That's how I felt what he was doing to me. It was like, "And you guys sit in the back and you don't get it." And he was just like sarcastic like that. And I remember I looked him in the eye and I connected with that Netashnia. I didn't say it out loud, but in my mind I said, "I'll show you, you white son of a bitch. I'll make it." I said, "You just help me get me going here." And what I found out was he was very wise. He was very smart. He figured out very early about the only thing he had to work with in me was my anger. And if he could find that level just to keep me, not that I would leave, but that I would come back for more or stay resentful, I think that's where he was good at. And he did that. He kept me mad, and he kept me right in that zone for for a long time. So then he said, "I decided," at the end of our talk, he says, "I just decided I'm going to be your friend for the rest of your life. I'm not asking you to be mine." He said, "It's got nothing to do with nothing. I just decided I'm going to be your friend, no matter what. That's it." And he said, "So what I'm going to help you do is," he said, "there's some things I know that you don't." And he said, "I'm willing to share some of those things that I know that you don't." And he says, "One of them," he says, "I know how to stay sober, and you little brown son, but you know nothing about staying sober." So he said, I do." And this is, you know, he's like, you know, like rubbing his face, you know, his hand on my face. And so anyway, he told me, he says, "I'm going to tell you some things I ain't." So we just want to be really, really clear. He says, "I ain't your taxi cab. So don't be calling me for no rides to meetings." He says, "I ain't your hotel. You'll never stay at my place," he said. "I ain't your banker. So don't come to me if you broke and you need money." And he went on and he was telling me about these things that he wasn't. Then he opened up the big book and he took 164 pages and he put them between his fingers like this. And he said, "But what I will give you is," he said, "if you are willing to do exactly what's in these 164 pages," he said, "you will never have to drink again." And he just paused. And he just had that connection with my eye. And I felt that transfer of truth. That he was saying something if it was in there, I wouldn't have to drink. And I think that's the first time I started to chirp and I wanted to cry. Because I tried everything I knew to not drink. And it just kept on. Because I never heard nobody say that. And so he opened up the page to where the 12 steps were. And he said, this is the program right here. And so he gave me an assignment. I had to read each of those 12 steps one at a time. And I had to say, do I want to do step one? I didn't have to. It was his belief half of AA was stayed sober and they never worked steps. He said, all they do is they borrow stories from guys who work them. That's how he thought, you know. And he said, number two, he said, are you willing to go to any length? So the way that he was going to show me was that my life was unmanageable. I didn't go, yup. There was more to it than yup, or agreeing that it was. As I found out later on, it was to look deep within my soul for my side of what was going on, you know, in my life. And so I went through those 12 proposals, and I come back to him, and I said, I wanted to do it, and I am willing to go to any length to do that. So then I was in Denver by then, and so he pulled out a pamphlet. And he circled six meetings, big book, traditions, step. And he had me pick this one meeting where there were all old guys at that meeting. And they had been there so long, when you go there, you couldn't sit in their chair. You know, that chair, that's where Bill's sitting, that chair, that's where another. And they had like a bench and some hard chairs, that's where the young guys sat. But you didn't sit in those chairs. And if you did, they'd let you know right away, you know. So I went there, and I don't know. I didn't understand why he sent me to that meeting, because each one of them said the same old crap every week that I went there, you know. And, you know, they'd say things like, you know, throw your shoes under the bed and get on your knees and do, you know, that whole story. And then the next one he'd tell another little story. They just kept saying the same old thing. And us young guys, we'd look at one another and it'd be like we'd lip sync. Throw your shoes under the bed. And, you know, kind of, because it was the same old crap that they was telling us. Later on, we found out how wise it was that he sent me to that darn meeting. There was some basic stuff going on there. So anyway, he circled those meetings, six of them. And he said, you have a choice. Sunday night, you go wherever you want or not go, but you got to go to these six meetings. And you go to these meetings, and he said, you say your name's Don. You say you're an alcoholic. Then he said, you shut up. He said, you got nothing of value that's going to ever help nobody stay sober. None. He said, so just shut up. Don't share. And that's how he talk. You go like, share, you know, don't share. Because he said, where your information comes from, he said, your head is like an inner ghetto. It's really dangerous in there, he says. Very, very bad. He said, you should never go in there alone, because when you do, you mug yourself. So he said, don't be sharing none of you know, the ghetto stuff. Just shut up. Until you take the third step, then you can share. And so he started to show me the instructions in the big book. And first 43 pages was the first half of step one, and I was to read that. And so I go to these meetings. Of course, AA's community is small, so everybody knows if you're not sharing, they go, we know who sponsors him. And then they try to get you to talk, you know, and stuff like that. But anyway, we went through that, and it was going good. I was going to meetings and going to all six and not sharing it. And one of the meetings I was going to was a place called Eagle Lodge. And so I would go there, and I come in and sit at this table kind of early one night. And as I'm sitting there, there were a lot of Native people went to that meeting. Some of you know about who Eagle Lodge was, but I would go there. And anyway, I'm sitting there, and I hadn't taken the third step yet. And this Indian gal walked in, sat down right across the table from where I was. And she looked me in the eye like that. And the connectedness went like that. And big old smile. And I thought, whoa. I'm not going to make no progress if I just say my name's Don and I'm alcoholic. That's all I say. So I was strategizing as it was getting my turn to speak. Then pretty soon I started to speak. On 449, this is what it says in that big book AA. And boy, I was just quoting that big old book, you know, all over the place. Her smile got that big, and I knew he was going for coffee. There was no doubt he was going for coffee. And we did. We went for coffee. And I come home that night, and I had a very little apartment. By then, I got kicked out of my house. And I remember walking up the sidewalk to my apartment. I felt like John Travolta. You know, I was like, I was just doing the deal, you know. And I gave her my phone number on a piece of paper. And as I unlocked my door to go in the apartment, the phone was ringing. And I said, she couldn't even wait. She had to call me right now, not even until the next day. So I went in there, I picked up that phone, and I think I probably had some kind of a voice, you know, that I guess you use maybe when you want to impress somebody like that, you know. And so I'm doing this, and I, hello. Guess who it was? My sponsor. They're like the damn internet. They're everywhere.
What are you doing moving your lips? I heard you were talking.
Got caught right off the bat. So then I continued to do that. And then he helped me with the second half of step one. And he showed me this paragraph. You know, I had read that big book the best that I could, and I was looking for these instructions you guys were always telling me about. I couldn't find them nowhere. I paged through it and page by page looking for, and I could never find no instructions in there. But then he showed me on page 52, there was a paragraph. He called it the unmanageability paragraph. And there were 9 areas to look at in there. We were having problems with personal relationships. So then he'd have me turn that into a question. Then I had to take a look at how I was doing in my personal relationships. And then I couldn't control my emotional nature. Flip it into a question. When I was angry, how did I act? I had to start taking a look at that. I retaliated, I withheld, I attacked, all kinds of crazy stuff I would do with my emotions that I used. And by the time I got done with those 9 areas, I didn't get along with nobody, not even myself. You know, I think I had this little philosophy for a long time. Well, if at first you don't succeed, fix the blame fast. It's this idiot I married, you know, or something else. I was always blaming somebody else, and I didn't have no skills on how do I look at me. And so I went in and I did that. Then he started talking to me about the steps are all interconnected with each other. They're not separate. They're in order, but they're interconnected with each other. So then he taught me to do we agnostics for step 2. And then I was to take those 9 areas that I looked at, bring those to step 2, and then I was to make 9 little mini visions, personal relationships. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could, and then to take a look at if God was running it, what my relationships look like. And I had to do that in those 9 areas. And when I took that back to him, he said, what you just wrote is 90% of what you're spiritual experience will be in step 12. If you want to know what that means in 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you look at what you just wrote in step 2. And you'll write more in inventory, more of the vision process. So I did that, and it felt good. And I guess that's why that principle for that step is hope. To think, wow, could this really, really happen? Could it be like this, even though I had no idea of doing so? So we got to step 3, and I had some problems with step 3. I was raised in a resident Wisconsin, and we had one church at the time on our reservation, and then different missionaries would come there. And so our parents, they'd drop us off there, or you had to go there for, you get some clothes and watermelon and, you know, stuff there at that church, whoever come in there. And then, of course, you always had to hear the pitch first. You know, you didn't get the donuts till the end of the meeting. You know, you don't eat them first. So we would go there, and then they train you on what you had to do, you know. So one of the churches, you go there, and then pretty soon everybody's standing up, and you're all going like this. That's how that church did it. And then pretty soon they'd run out of money or whatever, and they'd close it down, and it's empty for a little bit. And then pretty soon the other ones would come in. Catholics maybe would come in, and they would say, boy, are you lucky. Those ones that go like this, they're all going to hell. You're lucky we're coming. And then you go, phew, I'm glad too, you know that. And so then you couldn't do this. You had to do one of these. It was a different thing. And you know, to a little Indian kid, a nun is, they used to wear those habits, they call them in those days, big old sleeves. They have rulers up their sleeves and stuff like that. And they never smile. And they were all trying to help you to go to heaven. That's what seemed they were supposed to be doing. And so it's like they'd ask you, they'd say, you ever been burned with a cigarette? Yeah. In hell, those little marks are all over your body from your head down to your toes. That's how hell is. It's just really hot, and you got all these marks. And they'd say, you want to seek God? A little kid, you know, yes, I do. I don't want to have that on my body. And so then a little later, they'd say, not only is your body filled with blisters, but there ain't no water in hell. Now, do you want to go to, you want to go to heaven, you want to go to hell? Because in hell, there ain't no water. And then the little, you know, my imagination would go, whoa, this is heavy stuff, you know. And so they say, you know, you want to seek God? You bet I do, sister. You bet I do. You know, you just get it on. And it seemed to me like they had the flames of hell was licking your ass seeking God. You either seek God or you're going to hell. It was something unnatural about that. So when I was of age, I quit. Then I come to you guys, and you're saying, by the way, very early in this recovery step, you're going to have to make a decision to turn your life and over to the care of God. And you just go, oh, no. But whoever put that in there, God as you understand him, that's what made the difference. And so I didn't leave. I just kept listening to you guys, what you were saying about it. And then I was in a meeting in Denver. There was a guy from California there, and the meeting was on third step. And he told his story. Many of you probably heard that, but he said, this is how you make this decision about third step. Because I used to wonder about the will. I know where the ear is. I know where the nose is. But where the hell is the will? I could never figure out what that was. And then when I listened to you guys, you talk a lot about your will. Well, this morning I turned my will over to God, and I took it back. And then at noon I turned it over, and I took it back. And I turned it over, and I borrowed it, and I took it back. And so you were doing all these things with this will, and I couldn't figure out How do you make this decision to turn your will over and take it back, turn it over, take it back, turn it over, take it back? It felt very confusing. Until I heard this story. This guy said there was this pond and there was this log, four frogs sitting on this log. Then he said one of those frogs made a decision to jump in the water. Didn't jump, made this decision to jump. And he said in the third step, what that happens then, when you make that decision to turn your life and your will over, he said, God makes you an orange frog. So let's just say you make that decision on Wednesday, and then Friday you get angry and upset with somebody. He said, then all you are is you're just a pissed off orange frog. It hasn't changed that decision that you made between you and God. So what happens a week later? You go get drunk. He says, you're just a drunk orange frog. And so I saw something click for me that I could see what that step was asking. And I got really excited. And I remember I went over to Frank and I was really excited and I said, I knocked on the door and we got in, we sit down. And I says, Frank, I'm ready to take the third step. I said, I'm just really looking forward to become one of these orange frogs. And he said, he would like size me up, you know, and he'd shake his head and he'd say, I'm sure getting tired of this Indian shit working with you. He said, but if you want to become a frog, then let's go ahead and we'll do the frog thing, you know. So anyway, we went ahead and we did that. Then when that was done, I said, well, what's next? And he pulled out a tablet, a ruler, and a pencil. And by the time I left there, I was writing a 5-column resentment inventory. I knew how to do it with examples. I knew how to do a 4-column fear inventory. And he had me do an 11-column sex inventory. You know, where it says jealousy. Everyone was separate, so I could see the patterns. Even though the book has got them in the same sentence. And so I went ahead and I wrote that inventory. And I know he had told me that he wasn't the hotel. And one night I was sitting there and I was doing my inventory. And what came up for me was something happened when I was 9 years old back in the res. I was sexually abused by an uncle. And that went on for about a little over 2 years, maybe 2.5 years. And I never told nobody, and they work it like it's a secret. And so when I see him coming down the road, I'd run, jump in bed, make believe I was sick. And my mother would say, you lazy, get out there and cut wood. You got to get that wood up there. And then that went on. How it stopped was there was a big beer party on our reservation. And a fight broke out, and somebody shot him 6 times. They emptied a gun right in his chest, killed him. I remember how happy I was that that man was dead. But that was my mother's most favorite brother. They were like soul brothers or whatever you would call it, very, very close. And I always felt guilty of feeling happy when it made her, you know, made her sad. But I went ahead and I went over to his place, and he was married to a gal named Jenny. She was about half his size, just a little bitty gal. And as I entered the door that night, he was going to smart off, but she sensed something else was wrong. And she grabbed that big guy by the ear and took him into the room. I could hear some voices, you know. And she said, you're welcome to stay here this weekend. She said, you can write. And so I did. I stayed there that weekend and I wrote. And then I fifth-stepped. And I told everything. I was warned about the dark crannies. And I had everything was on there. It was good. Then I was to review those proposals, and I did that. And I call them up. And I remember the first time I experienced, they told me that all the odd steps has a set of promises. And so I didn't know what that really meant until the fifth step promises. And they said, if you meet the condition, then claim the promise. Then it's yours. You can look the world in the eye. You can be at perfect peace and ease. And I was told that all the promises in the big book, they're conditional. So you get the promise, but the condition is withholding nothing. That's the condition. Then you get a cookie. But You withhold something, you don't get the cookie. You don't get the benefits of the promise. And so I went through and I read that. I read those promises line by line, and I've just felt this, some kind of a thing transformed inside. And so I went ahead and I did the rest of the steps and took the information out of the inventories for step 6 and 7, and I did those, and I got to amends. And so amends was a little bit difficult. I'm going to just close with the story on amends. I found that when I got there, I did not want to do this thing around my sexual abuse. I didn't want to do that. So I went to see Johnny Looking Cloud, and he told me, he said, if you want some help, he said, I'll tell you about forgiveness, how it works. And he said, there's 4 steps to forgiveness. He said, 2 of them you can do, and then 2 of them you can't do. And so he said, I'll tell you about 1 at a time. You got to do it before I tell you about the rest. So he said, the story about you and your uncle is, he said, it is important in this process of forgiveness to know where you're going to go to forgive. He said, it's not back on the res. It's not back home. As he said, it's in here. The location of the work is in my head. And, yeah, but you don't understand. I know. He said, come back 1 moon. I want you to think about it. Don't call me. Don't talk to me. You think about it. And it took that long. I had all his arguments going. He don't really understand. He's an old guy and whatever. Finally, it clicked. I went, oh, my God, I know what he's saying. It's in there. So I went back to him, and he was comfortable that I had got it. So he said, okay, this is the 2nd step that you can do before you get to the one that you can't do. And he said, in your head, there's a story about what happened. And he said, you wrote the story. You were the author of the story of what went on about that experience. Yeah, but you don't understand. He did this and he... I know. But when he did all of that, he said, you're the author. Inside of you, you wrote the story of that whole event. And he said, if I know you like I think I do, he said, I wouldn't doubt you added to the story. Maybe there's some other things in there that didn't really, really, really happen. And so it took a month for me to realize what he was saying. Then finally I saw what he was saying. There's a story in there, and I did write it. I could describe. I was the one described what happened, how it felt, and all that crazy stuff that went on with that. So he come back, and he was satisfied with what I had done. And he said, the 3rd thing, he said, you can't do. So he said, this is what you do. He said, remember that place up on that ridge where we did that ceremony? I said, yeah. He said, I want to go up there, and he said, build an altar. Then he made me some medicine mixed with couscous, cedar, sage. He had it mixed together, and he says, you go up there and you put this medicine in the shell. Then he said, you take your shirt off, and then you dig down in the dirt about that far, and you get that dirt, and then you wash your skin like the animals do. They cleanse in the dirt. He said, wash the top part of your body in there. And then he said, light that medicine. And he said, what you do is, you got to use this very word, specific word. He said, you got to use the word Holy Spirit, not Creator, not Tenkashala, not God. You got to use this word very specifically. And he said, what you do is you ask that Holy Spirit to come in to give you a new story, a story that will make you free. And so I was so new in sobriety, I was uncomfortable how to do this. And so I did all the, you know, washed my body and all this stuff and made the altar and I lit it. And so then the real dialogue that day was, I said, all right, I said, I'm up here because Johnny Lunkenclaw told me to come up here. And what he said to do, he said to tell you this. And so that's what I'm doing here. And I said, he told me that if I use one of your names, the Holy Spirit, and ask you if I could get a new story, that I could be free of this thing that happened. And I said, so that's why I'm here. That's what I wanted to do. And so I did that ceremony, and that's exactly what happened. I was given the new story. I can go think of whatever I want to think about happened, and I'm not no prisoner. I could tell in a men's group, I could tell you exactly the details of what happened, how it felt, and whether something hurt or whether you were scared or run, and about keeping secrets about it. I could say all of that now. I didn't know that. And I turned around and I did it 23 times. I was so full of hate that I didn't have the power to think my way to forgiveness. I had to go to this being called Holy Spirit, whatever that was. And he told me, you know, not to do that. And so that was things that changed things. And after amends, what happened there was, I was very close to my sister in those days. She lived in Denver. And one of the things started to happen is I started to feel. And I didn't know what these things were. It was just, you'd have these things, like, you'd come up. And so I would go to her, and I would say, I would try to describe that what happened maybe that day, that event. And when I would get done, she'd say, that's the feeling that you get when you care. I thought caring was when you did something for somebody. I didn't know there was a feeling that came with it. I didn't know when you cried, I could get a lump in my throat. That wouldn't be my tears or my, it was yours. I didn't know I could do that. And I all of a sudden, I go up and I tell her this, and she said, well, this is what that is. And there were people in AA, they thought I was drinking again because I had such a personality change. I had a hard time at first holding hands in AA. I couldn't believe that you did hold on hands of the guy. I just could not get over that, you know. And then so things changed a lot. So what I learned was that feeling that you guys gave me, it's kind of a tribal thing. It's how you feel when you belong to a clan. It's hard to describe, but you're not abandoned. You don't have abandonment issues when you belong to some of the cultural things, you know, that we know about. So you can have something, your parents can die and you're sad and everything, but you still belong to something bigger. It was designed, you know, to see that way. So I go through the work every year. I have not the last 2 years. My sister passed on, and I just have not gathered up the gumption to go through that. I know I need to do that very, very soon. I have an issue with one of my granddaughters that I'm very puzzled as to what to do. So I'm back to Al-Anon. Because that's where I know, you know, the answers, you know, will be for that. So I'll just close with this prayer that I, seems like everything I know, if it's any value, I got from you. That's how it seems. You're in a prayer, you know. And I'll close with this prayer, and it says, God, thank you for what you've given me. God, thank you for what you've taken from me. And God, thank you for what you've left me. And look at this. To stand in front of this Al-Anon group from all over our Turtle Island, and to the Al-Ateens, and hearing them share their stories and all of that, that's my life. That's my life. So thank you very much.